Hello and welcome to Build Momentum, a show where we explore thought leadership and education. I'm Sarah Williamson, the founder of SWPR Group.
And I'm Katie Lash, the director of the East Central Educational Service Center.
Together, we explore how to leverage key partners, your constituencies, and the media to authentically impact your organizations and the leaders who champion them. We can't wait to get started, so let's dive into today's show.
Welcome to Build Momentum. Our guest today can be described as an educator, learner, advocate, and agent of change as we focus on thought leadership for education. That description certainly affirms that we absolutely had to invite Christina Ishmael on our show. She's making a national impact on the field of education with her work in EdTech policy as the Deputy Director in the Office of EdTech for the U.S. Education Department. We are so excited to dive in. Thanks for being on the show.
Thanks so much. I'm excited to dive in with you.
Awesome. There was a piece of this that I think is like super cool that Christina, like when I was, that's a direct quote at the beginning of that intro. And that's on like a federal government website. How many people have like a federal government description about themselves? That's pretty cool, I think. So you
baller,
can Google that later.
Baller.
I like it.
Yes. So we had the pleasure of meeting at ISTE at that really awesome Mosaic Outlier Party. So fun.
Yep. Yeah.
So it's just super fun to see you again and have you on our show. I'd love for you to talk about, it's pretty interesting how you're in your position right now. Could you share how you got into education and then also how you ended up at the Office of EdTech?
Yeah, absolutely. Apologies to those that have already heard my story, but it's one of those like I never saw myself in policy. So it is kind of entertaining to think about in that way. But I originally started in business and mass communication and had one of my first interviews when I had moved to Omaha, Nebraska with my former husband. And I had a massive panic attack. And I was like, I'm actually not supposed to do this. Okay. And that was one of those moments I was like, oh, I've just been trying to pretend that education is not what I'm supposed to do, but I need to listen to my actual heart here and my gut and go. So I went back to school at that point and I was teaching preschool while I was doing that and then pursued early childhood and elementary education and then was a kindergarten teacher, a second grade dual language Spanish teacher. So I taught all content in Spanish and then was in second grade kind of inclusion teacher for a while and then moved districts and I was an EL teacher kindergarten through sixth grade. So I would pull out, do interventions, especially with newcomers, and then try to push in and co-teach with folks. In that role, I was pursuing my second master's in ed tech and did my action research was focused on professional learning for teachers across the state of Nebraska. And if they had access to professional learning to integrate technology, and lo and behold, it was good, but it was not great. And there also happened to be a position that opened up at the state level at that point for the digital learning specialist. And so that was sent my way by one of my former colleagues who I had met at a conference when I was presenting while teaching kind of moment. And I got the job. I got to fulfill my contract and finish out the year with students. But then I moved right to the state level from there. So I left the classroom, no district level in there, but classroom to state level.
Wow.
And it was a brand new position. Yeah. So it was a brand new position that I got to create as I went along and knowing that they really wanted half the job to be internal and focused on the policy development and the relationship building, the coalition building with federal programs, with curriculum and instruction, with the assessment team. And then the other half of the job was going out into the field. And Nebraska is actually a very large state, especially now that I live in DC, which is a very tiny state, not an official state, but I'm going to call it a state. And I would go across the entire state, usually quarterly. I lived in Omaha, worked in Lincoln, and then would kind of navigate all over the state and provide professional learning on anything and everything EdTech related, and especially around like copyright fair use and open educational resources. And that actually led me to my fellowship at OET back in 2016. And so I was already in that space and the position opened up at OET at the time. And so I had the incredible opportunity to move out to DC back in April 2016. I was a one-year fellow, so I bridged administrations for a few months. And then the Hewlett Foundation, who had funded that project, supporting states and schools as we moved away from traditional textbooks and materials to the use of open educational resources, are somewhat unique in the sense that it's a foundation that also supports individuals sometimes. And I happen to be one of the individuals. And so they were like, we really want to see this work continue and grow. Kind of like, where do you want to go from here? And so I ended up in DC at a think tank and at New America. And so I was a part of their public interest technology team, as well as their ed policy program. And so I got to work with folks that had just come out of the Obama administration on, you know, like civic technology and what was my role in that, as well as on the ed policy program and continuing to build out kind of the OER portfolio across the country. From there, I went to an international open education organization and had planned to go abroad for a year. And then the pandemic hit. So all plans went out the window. Yeah. And we were safe and healthy and we were good. So I will take that. But in that process, you know, it's like the universe puts you where you need to be. And I was fortunate enough to join the Biden-Harris transition team and be a part of the Department of Education's agency review team. And it was that moment where I was like, oh yeah, purpose-filled, like mission-driven work. I miss this stuff so much. And anxiously, patiently, impatiently, whatever you want to call it, waited for a position to open up in the department. And that I just celebrated my 1 year anniversary. And so
amazing.
On paper, I'm the deputy director of the office. In practice, I'm the director. I get two jobs in one. leading a small and mighty team. There are eight of us. And yeah, developing national ed tech policy.
That is a story. That is incredible. I mean, that is an incredible career journey. Thank you for sharing that. It's inspiring.
It's unique, right?
Yeah, totally unique. I mean, the fact that you went from straight from the classroom, that's incredible.
Yeah.
I love it. What's a day in the life like today for you? Can you just tell us a little bit more about that?
I would say that no 2 days are the same, but that's not really true because there's just a lot of meetings. a lot of meetings and a lot of emails and connection with the field, as well as kind of coalition building. This office has historically, so this was an office that was established in the mid-90s. Congress actually like had the foresight to be like, hey, technology is going to mean something in education. We should have an office that focuses on that. And so we are congressionally mandated to exist. That does not mean that we get the money or the people to come alongside that, but we are mandated to exist to develop national ed tech policy. And so we've been in that space since the mid-90s, and we rely on our Lighthouse publication to really kind of drive that policy, which is called the National Ed Tech Plan. And so that is kind of updated on a cyclical basis, almost like your curriculum adoption. So we just kicked off the work to revise that plan back in September. So that'll be another 14, 16 month kind of process that we'll be doing. But in general, it's meeting with my colleagues across the Department of Education. Today, I was in a policy committee meeting where I got to make sure that when they were talking about, you know, different types of assessments, they were saying like, what are the different ways that we see assessment delivered? And I was like, well, statewide assessments, we deliver, you know, via technology now in the majority of our states. And so what are the things that we're thinking ahead about, like whether it's actual devices or high-speed reliable internet to make sure that there is strong connectivity? Do we have students that are, especially our youngest learners and my former learners, do we have kindergartners that are ready to get on a device and take an assessment? Not necessarily. And so
I'll tell you, mine is not. Nope.
So it's consultation with other offices and making sure that ed tech and all things digital learning are kind of thought about from the ground up when it comes to policy. We review the policy or the publications that are coming out from other offices so that we make sure that, you know, there's always kind of a say from the office. And then just, again, kind of connecting with the field as much as possible, staying grounded in the current practices, but also about like what's on the horizon. We've got a report that we're working on right now about AI in education. And this will be like the first kind of thing that comes out from the Department of Ed on that topic. And so it's pretty exciting.
That's so cool. That's great.
Are you an education leader, the leader of an ed tech company, or a member of an organization supporting education? We continue to hear from leaders like you who have a story to tell, a message to share, or an important initiative that needs greater awareness. 3 years ago, that's exactly what we heard from Doug Roberts, the CEO of the Institute for Education Innovation, when he approached SWPR Group.
This led to the launch of a groundbreaking new award that was unlike any other in EdTech. The SUPS Choice Awards, judged exclusively by K-12 superintendents, set IEI on a path to market dominance, increasing vendor partners and superintendent members by more than 30% year over year. Jamie Candy, the CEO of Edmentum, shared with SWP PR Group the EdTech company's desire to tell district success stories and to elevate the leaders behind their organization in a more thoughtful and strategic way. Throughout the past 2 years, SWP PR Group has established consistent and regular media coverage, authored compelling op-eds, and secured interviews highlighting success stories while also inserting Edmentum into timely topics like AI with national reporters. At SWP PR Group, we provide public relations, communication strategies, and thought leadership support for today's change makers and the brands they champion. We work together with our clients to bring their mission to life by consistently delivering high-quality content, creative communication strategies, and transformational results. What story do you want to tell? Reach out to us using the link in the show notes or visit our website at swpr-group.com.
That's very, very exciting. I am nerding out on what you just said because I Well, it's so interesting. I would have told you just a couple of years ago that like policy sounded like super intimidating or something. Like policy sounds like a big word. And now like, I feel like that's like what I do. Like how did this happen? So we haven't met in person before, but I would love to.
Yes.
But anyway, work with our state team often. And in other episodes of this show, I've talked a lot about, you can probably tell as I'm talking right now that like my video is a little bit fuzzy because I live in rural Indiana. And so I've talked about like having to report for my daughters. Like I'm actually in the big city right now. Like I am calling you from the big city in Randolph County. But I say that to say, I was reading about your work in Nebraska where you studied some of this and equity challenges. And I'm again, so curious about your work federally in the same conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's interesting. So Nebraska is one of 7 states that do not allow charters. So they have a very strong public school system. And there were also a lot of one room schoolhouses that had to be consolidated too across the entire kind of state. And so when I was there in 2013, that's when I first started there. And I think even through like 2016, when I left for DC, about 245 public school districts across the entire state. And it really varied. I mean, you had Omaha Public Schools, my former district, that is actually the same size as Boston and San Francisco Unified. It's about 54,000-55,000 pre-K through 12. And then you've got some of the, you know, the suburban areas nearby that are still part of Omaha or in Lincoln. And then you've definitely got your rural districts that have only, you know, anywhere from 25 to 50 learners across their K-12. And so it's interesting because we think the infrastructure more often is available in the larger urban or suburban areas. But what I found across the more rural areas, the infrastructure as far as like the reliable high-speed internet may not have necessarily been there. But I did notice that they were more agile and they were more willing to try the ed tech and the tech integration in general because they could quickly, they could pivot, our favorite word of 2020, they could quickly move around, you know? And so, but you also see the inequities, of course. And even my first year teaching in Omaha Public Schools, there were inequities that I would see because I was in a magnet school in South Omaha, so a large Latinx population, and we had Spanish, math, and technology that were our magnets. So we had not only our regular school budget, our Title I budget, then we had a magnet budget for all of those things. So I had access to technology way more than my colleagues down the street at the other like regular elementary school. And so I saw those inequities right away. And I remember having those conversations when we would do like district-wide professional learning, where I would be with my other kindergarten colleagues or second grade colleagues. And I pulled out my MacBook because all of us in my building had MacBooks and the other schools didn't have that. And I was like, wait a minute, what? You know, and like, and you start to see even those things firsthand from the very beginning. And I mean, you understand it. And so it's not necessarily just making sure that everyone has access to the same things. We know that, but the things that they need, that's going to meet them where they need. And so we talk a lot about that now, of course, with the digital equity work that we're doing in the office. And we have two of our team members who have been focusing on that for the past year and led an initiative called Digital Equity Education Roundtables, because they were able to identify like the five populations that are furthest from those digital equity and opportunities, students of color, students from rural areas, students from urban areas that have been digitally redlined, where, you know, one street has access to connectivity and then the next street over doesn't have access. Our Native and Indigenous students, as well as our higher ed adult learners, those that are involved with justice system, kind of that whole range of our adult learners as well. And so we wanted to hear the voices of these populations in any sort of publication that we would put out. And we were able to identify kind of the three elements of that digital equity, which are availability, affordability, and adoption. And like, we've been working on the availability. We've been working on that for a long time, the actual infrastructure, the pipes and the wires and the fiber in the ground. And then you've got the affordability, which is hard a lot of times. We've certainly made efforts with the federal government's programs like the Affordable Connectivity Program that has that $30 subsidy that more or less can cover a lot of people's broadband service because of the interest from the internet service providers to also provide something that's affordable for folks. But it's an adoption piece too. Unless it's coming from a trusted community-based organization, then we have a lot of people that are like, I'm good. I don't need these programs, or I'm not interested in your program here. And so those are kind of the things that we've been working on in the digital equity space now within OET. And how do we continue to lift up the community work that requires those relationships that are deeply ingrained in that community?
Yes, you speak my language, because we certainly see that. I serve a bunch of school districts, so I have some more urban settings. So what you're describing is so true. Like, it depends where you live if you have access within that community. But then also, I think then some of our rural districts, they may not have the fiber optic in the ground. Actually, I'm advocating for that right now in my community where I live. But anyway, they might not have the fiber in the ground, but somebody said this the other day and it so resonated. One of my more rural districts, he said, you know, we are not a cruise ship, but we're a kayak and we can move, like we can turn a lot quicker. And yes. I was like,
that's it.
And I thought that was so smart.
I need to find out who said that, because I want to use that.
I'll connect you. You
need a proper attribution. Okay, great.
Yeah. He said, yeah. I loved that analogy. So when you said that, this was just a conversation the other day of like, we have some pretty special things because we can scoot.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. Absolutely.
Well, rural districts have been doing it long before the pandemic. I think you guys had a head start.
Yeah.
Katie, I mean, you've had to be innovative. Otherwise, what would you do? Right?
Yeah.
Survival.
Yeah. Survival, right? I will never forget, Sarah, since I know that you'd mentioned Oregon. A dear friend of mine is the former state ed tech director for Oregon, Carla Wade, who's now at COSIN. And one of the first CETA meetings, which is the State Ed Tech Directors Association, of which I used to be a part of as a state folk, but she mentioned like some of the rural areas having satellites for access, and then heavy snowfall, they'd have to go out and shovel the snow off the satellites. And I was like, wait, what? I mean, we got snow in Nebraska, but I don't know if anyone was doing that. So I found that really that is when you know, the principal is out there and so is the second grade teacher that's helping with that. That's the beauty of small rural districts as well.
Yes. Oh my goodness. Okay. So I'm curious, Christina, how and when and if do you work with ed tech providers? So I partner with a lot of ed tech providers through our company, SWPR Group. It's a PR agency focused on ed tech. So I'm curious, I know it's a sensitivity for you, but do you ever work with those organizations to find out what they're doing?
That is definitely one of our charges as well, is as we're developing policy, we have to stay informed by the field. And that's not just the practitioners, but that's also the developers and the entrepreneurs. So this is something new that we're trying in the office. I think it's working right now. We're a couple months into this little pilot here, but I was really kind of cognizant about coming back into government because I don't really think there were a lot of healthy boundaries the last time that I was in this role. And there were expectations for communication at any time of the day, at night for that matter, or early morning. And I was like, we're not doing that. And so
good for you.
So we helped kind of establish those healthy boundaries. And one of those boundaries that we set up was like, we as a team have to stay informed in the research and the current kind of events that are happening. So we've instituted a no meetings Friday so that we can spend time not only catching up on the correspondence with folks from the field, but also like making sure that we are reading and that we are, you know, perhaps doing more professional learning on our own, because we need to be modeling that learning as well. But the second Friday of the month, we've held for meeting with folks. And that's where, so like after EdTech Week in September, I had quite a few people that wanted to connect with us and say like, you know, either a demo or find out more information about our office. And that holding that kind of sacred second Friday of the month has been really good. And so we stack those meetings and, you know, it's a marathon. And so I also have to, you said the sensitivity, like that is a really important thing for us to note as well. Like we cannot endorse content, curriculum, tools, software, hardware, like any of that. So we have to walk that fine line. And then unlike some of my other offices at Ed, we're not a grant-making office either. So we have no money to give anyone. We just get to develop the policy.
That's actually awesome though, because then you could be like, they're not in it for money because I've got none. So like, it's fine.
And so, I mean, we have those ongoing conversations, or like I was at CETA the past 2 days, their leadership summit here in DC, and they have their partners. So I got to meet some new folks yesterday, like they want to connect afterwards. And so again, it allows us to stay connected. One of my favorite words that I learned about whenever I got to the federal level is the bully pulpit. And that is where we get to leverage the power of the office, of the administration and like the agency itself. And so we have a pretty unique convening power that does not exist in many other places. And so I can call up the folks from X, Y, and Z company to say, hey, we're going to have this convening. We need to talk about AI in education. We need to talk about the ethics and the use of your algorithms. Come join that conversation. And they're going to come, because they want to be a part of that conversation.
Yeah.
And so there are those kinds of pieces that we also get to like flex that bully pulpit. It's also just mm-hmm. a really fun word to say, but the bully pulpit. And so we get to do that. And that's how we really stay connected to the ed tech side of things.
Yeah. Brilliant. That's great. Okay. Thank you for answering that.
Mm-hmm.
What about one more question on that subject is there any product out there that I know during the pandemic, we saw tons and tons of tutoring companies and SEL companies. Is there any product? I'm sure you saw that as well. Anything that sprung up that you think we still need that you aren't seeing?
That's a good question. I don't know if it's necessarily a product, but I'm really, perhaps it's because we have been focused on the AI in education and as far as like the future of teaching and learning, but I'm really eager to see where AI is going to take us. I know that there are risks, don't get me wrong. And like, we want to acknowledge that there are risks, but I also, perhaps it's the optimist in me, but I just see all of the opportunities that are going to come with this as well. And, you know, I had the chance to meet with a vendor at South by Southwest EDU back in March. And as a former early childhood and elementary teacher, I was like, why didn't this exist when I was in the classroom? Because it was a diagnostic for reading, for fluency and comprehension. And the learners would get on, they would record the reading passage, and it did all of the actual like running record check marks, the substitutions, the omissions, the deletions, like all that for you. And I mean, I spent hours of instructional time doing that with each of my learners when I could have been providing more targeted intervention, whatever the case may have been. And I just see some of that technology being applied in classrooms that we're just on the like the very early stages of that right now.
I agree. Yeah. So it's better than Dibbles?
Sure.
Dibbles is still a thing. It's just now we do it in like other ways. Yeah.
That is true. That is true.
What a great word. Dibbles. Are you kidding me? I mean, really.
You know what?
Kind of like the bully pulpit or whatever you said, bully pit, whatever.
The bully pulpit, yeah.
When the teacher told me that dibbles were a thing, I was like, what? Dibbles? Anyway, kind of funny.
So that's still a very well-used, like lots of companies, but yeah, still a thing.
It's a thing. It's a thing.
It's just not like how we used to do it. Not how we used to do it.
Right. Right.
Okay.
So Christina, you said your department doesn't have any money, but you know who does have money? Lots of school districts that are getting all of these relief dollars. And companies happen to know that districts have this money, which obviously, again, schools need this money. This is desperately a need that's really accelerated what we've needed for a long time. But again, they are getting it from every angle of like, let me tell you how you could use your ESSER dollars. That's pet peeve of mine, by the way. I don't like that. But anyways, we qualify for ESSER. Okay. That's okay.
Yeah.
But tell me what you do. Right. Anyway. Yep. So what ideas or advice do you have for districts in trying to prioritize or sort through that? Because it's an exciting time, but it's hard. It's hard.
It is. It is. I think it comes back to knowing your why in your school district. And also it comes down to needs assessments. Like, what do our learners need in this moment? Do we need to invest more in social emotional learning and mental health services? Do we need to invest more in our connectivity and devices because we know that this is going to fall off at the end of this year and we need to think about the money right now for that? Or do we need to look at more teacher recruitment and retainment? And so it really comes down to the priority areas, but it has to start with the why. Like, why are we doing this? How are we serving our community? And then making sure that there's representation from folks as you're thinking about each of those areas. And so whenever I led Go Open, it was, you know, the district would make the decision to move away from a traditional textbook to the use of OER, but it had to be this team from across the district. It had to be classroom teachers. You had to include your librarian or your MEDA specialist because they're trained in this, to your district level decision makers, your chief academic officer, your director of curriculum and instruction. I think that that also has to be replicated in how you're thinking about spending these dollars as well. Is like, you have to have representation across your entire district. And for that matter, we're a student voice and parent and caregiver voice in all of this, because I'm sure that they have some different feelings about things too.
Now, I appreciate what you're saying though. It's really, that's the student voice, I think, is so easy to sometimes, you know, we make a lot of decisions really quickly because we have to. And then why did we do that?
Yeah. And I think the other thing right now, as we are thinking about the millions of dollars that are out in schools, we're also hearing from people that are like scared to spend it. And the secretary and my director, the assistant secretary, have reminded us recently, please spend your money. Half of Congress didn't want schools to have these relief dollars. We need everyone to spend their money.
I know. And a lot, they're not a lot of them. So yeah, spend it.
That's an interesting note. I don't want to take us off tangent, but Christina, I want to be your best friend because I want to learn from you all of this too. Like, define when the money is spent, right? Encumbered versus like implemented, but I digress. But that's is so interesting that, yeah.
Okay. One more question for me, Christina. So I'm just curious. You kind of talked about the future of education being really AI focused. On this show, we really talk about thought leadership and how we can work together with ed tech companies, school district leaders, and really embrace that from both sides. And I'm just curious, what you think really is the future of education? How are these ed tech partners going to help support, take us there? How is that going to shake out?
Yeah. I mean, it's nothing new in the sense that even as much as I love technology and I saw what technology could do in the hands of my multilingual learners when I was in the classroom, not only for language acquisition, but for content acquisition as well. It is a tool. It is a tool. It is not meant to substitute the teacher. And as we are developing kind of our report on AI in education, the phrase that we keep coming back to is the human in the loop. And like, how are we incorporating educators as we think about the development of new tools and solutions, whether it's using AI or machine learning or whatever, you know, the actual technology is, how are we making sure that educators are involved in that process? Because there are a lot of really smart people out there that are like, oh, I remember when I was in K-12, this was a problem. when's the last time you actually talked to someone to make sure that that is indeed still a problem? And then how do they develop those solutions alongside? Like, we need to co-design with educators and with learners. And so I don't know if it's necessary. Like I said, I don't know if it's really new by any means, but I just see some companies that are intentionally reaching out to educators, you know, compensating them for their time, making sure that they're not, you know, expecting free labor by any means, but then they're co-designing some of these solutions and it's just different. It it functions differently when you see it co-designed with education and with those educators at your side.
Yeah. I love that. It's a great answer.
Me too. It's like, we need the students, like our decisions impacting students, but also what we're developing, helping the teachers. Like, so we kind of talked a little bit about this earlier, but I'm fascinated by policy, education policy. So when you get a stage in front of district leaders, what priorities you highlight? I've sensed a few of them already, but then what policy do you see ahead?
Yeah. So we spent some time at the beginning of this year when the secretary had released his priorities for this administration and kind of for the Department of Education under President Biden. We really wanted to focus on response and recovery from the pandemic, of course. We wanted to look at achievement gaps, which we know are quite wide right now, especially with new NAEP scores that recently released. We wanted to look at making higher education affordable and accessible. And then we also wanted to look at the pathways for higher education. You know, there are multiple different ways to get there. And it may not necessarily be higher education. It may be more career focused. So what are the different pathways there? We also have been working on the pipeline, which is, I think, just an ongoing thing that we have to address, whether it's recruitment or retention. We are deeply understaffed across the entire country. So once we saw those priorities come out, our team spent quite a bit of time saying, okay, what does this look like then for our office? What are we going to focus on? Yes, we know that the National Ed Tech Plan has to come out of our office. We need a revision that will be coming over the next 14, 16 months, however long it's going to take. But how do we then think about these priorities within the context of ed tech? And so we kind of framed everything through digital equity and opportunity, because once we get that digital equity, we get to those opportunities. And the charge of our office is not only developing national ed tech policy for K-12, it's actually P-12, higher education and adult learning or workforce. And so we have that entire continuum to consider. And that's, I mean, like, that's a big lift. So what are the ways that we can think of, you know, tying it back to the priorities where we can see P-12 here and higher education or adult education over here? And what are the ways that we're going to get that and operationalize kind of that charge? So digital equity and opportunity. And then our three priorities within that are digital inclusion, ecosystems, and emerging trends and technologies. And so with the bipartisan infrastructure law that President Biden signed a year ago, November of 2021, we knew that that was going to bring a lot of money to infrastructure, especially towards broadband. And we also got, for the first time ever, codified in law, we have the definition of digital equity and digital inclusion. And so we took that. We're going to build off of that. And so digital inclusion is not only connectivity and devices, but it's also access to content. And so we wanted to expand that to also talk about instructional models, especially when we're using technology. And then technical assistance to make sure that folks can actually operate the devices and the connectivity that's being given to them or, you know, figured out in their homes. And then the final piece is digital literacy. We did a really good job in March of 2020 and at the beginning months of the pandemic, trying to get out hotspots and kind of that emergency remote learning to ensure continuity of learning. And sometimes there's paper packets. Trust me, those hotspots don't always work in rural places. We know that. But we also recognize that was just the first step. And, you know, the districts that have been one-to-one and have been sending computers or devices home for quite some time already knew this long before the pandemic, but that was just the first step. So what are the skills that we now need to make sure that everyone can not only get on their devices, but then navigate the different tools and the applications? And so that's where the digital literacy, which also encompasses information literacy, mis- and disinformation, media literacy, how do we navigate the different types of media that are coming, like digital citizenship, that all falls in within that digital literacy. And then we moved on to the ecosystems, which I was thinking boxes and wires, like boxes and wires. We need to think about the infrastructure, that backbone that everything works off of. And so that's student data privacy, cybersecurity, interoperability. Are these different tools that we are using talking to one another? Most often they're not.
Oh my gosh, I know, right?
And accessibility. And so when I presented that to Assistant Secretary Roberto Rodriguez, he said, love it, but where are the humans? Like, where are the humans in your ecosystem? And I was like, okay. And so, you know, like we had to go back and think about that. Well, educators and educational leaders are part of our ecosystem. And then families and communities, because we could not have done what we did in the past 3 years without our families and communities. And so then we kind of added them on as part of like, not only the digital infrastructure, but we also need the humans as part of our ecosystems. And while the digital inclusion and the ecosystems work kind of stays grounded in the current practices, we also have to keep our eye on the horizon of what's coming. And so that's where the emerging trends and technologies comes into play. And that's leveraging the Bully Pulpit to vision and bring those folks together. It's talking to developers about responsible use and design. Are you responsibly thinking about how you design X tool to work with preschoolers? I don't know. Let's have that conversation. And then the last one is on evidence. And this is something that we're still like, we're at the very beginning of this work as well. Our office historically has done some work in rapid cycle tech evaluation, which is because you can't do like your traditional research for ed tech because the tool changes so quickly. So if you want to study like this tool in a second grade classroom, and it takes a 2 or 3 year study, that tool is very different 2 or 3 years later. And so how can we think about it more like action research and iterate on the types of things that we put in front of our learners and then make changes accordingly? And we know that with ESSA, Every Student Succeeds Act that was signed into law in 2015, as well as all of the relief dollars, we're supposed to be making decisions and purchases based on evidence. And not everyone knows that. There are the 4 levels of evidence, and it can start level 1. Like maybe it's just a logic model that an ed tech company has put together to say, hey, we think this is our theory of change. If you put this in a classroom, we think then this will happen. That is level 1 to level 4 that has been studied and peer reviewed and all of that. But that evidence piece is another missing piece right now. And so we're trying to start working that space.
We're hearing that more and more states are creating, or at least school districts are requiring that evidence to be a part of an RFP or a metric, that that's becoming more great. Commonplace. Yeah.
Great.
Love I think that is that. Shifting. Yeah.
I think, Katie, that goes back to what you were saying about the relief dollars, where you've got all of these vendors sending the thing saying, hey, we can take your money. We can take your money. Great. Show me the evidence. Wouldn't that be a fun conversation to be a part of?
Yeah, absolutely. No, that's so interesting though, the amount of spaces that you get to work, like all of the, I mean, you talked about ecosystem, but all of those things you described are just part of this.
Yep.
Yeah. That's amazing.
Yeah.
It's super amazing. You're truly making an agent for change, I should say. You're an agent for change. I love it.
Thank you. Making I appreciate waves. That.
Yes. Thank you, Christina.
Do you have more questions, Sarah? Are we wrapping
I
up?
I don't. We're going,
this is a great
Let's
conversation.
Wrap it up. Yeah, we're getting so, long here.
It's great though. Like this
it's
is,
so
one,
great.
I mean, this is one of my favorites so far. I mean, maybe I shouldn't have said
Me
that
too.
A lot. All of them are my favorites, but anyway. So Christina, great to have you. If people want to know more about your work, how should they reach out to you? What's the best way to learn what you're doing?
Yeah. Tech.ed.gov. is our website, and it is a living, breathing website. It is an anomaly in that our office gets to own it. So trust me when I say I have access to our website and I am updating it on a weekly basis.
Wow.
That is true. Not everyone can say that.
Yes.
And for good or bad or for better or worse, I don't know right now, we are on Twitter and we are still communicating with folks on Twitter. Whether or not you have stayed or you have decided to leave that platform, I do not know. But we are Office of Ed Tech on Twitter.
Awesome. This is so fantastic. Christina, I hope to see you at a conference coming up. Hopefully you're traveling again soon.
Me too.
Look forward to that. Thank you again for chatting with us today.
Absolutely. Thank you.
If you're looking for more of this thought leadership goodness for your organization, you're in the right place. Visit us at swpr-group.com to learn more about how we work with education organizations and their leaders, superintendents, and influencers to increase your impact. Again, that's swpr-group.com. Thanks for tuning in today, and we will see you next time on Build Momentum.